أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين. ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين. من ليلتنا هذه إلى قيام يوم الدين. We're thankful to Allah Ta'ala for allowing us to participate in a majlis for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The crescent moon of the month of Muharram has dawned upon us. And this is the time where we wear our black clothes, we decorate our centers, we take out the time and sacrifice, and we come together as a community to mourn. And I'd like to begin by sending my salam to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. As-salamu ala al-Husayn wa ala Ali ibn al-Husayn wa ala awlad al-Husayn wa ala ashab al-Husayn. The month of Muharram gives us an opportunity to remember the purpose for why we're here, to connect with the higher goal of our creation, to remind ourselves of our identity. Through these lectures, we get a chance to be reminded about some of those important reminders that all of us need. And typically, the speakers will choose a topic. The topic that I've chosen for this series is, inshallah, surrounding the concept of dhulm. And so what I'd like to do tonight, inshallah, is to spend a bit of time just giving an introduction to the topic and talking about dhulm from a perspective of the Quran and the overall Islamic perspective. But then I want to switch gears then to talking about some of the history and the purposes behind the majlis of Imam Hussein, and what is it that we can do to make the most out of it? Because after all, we're going to, inshallah, be investing time and energy and efforts night after night. So it's good for us to understand the purpose and kind of have a good groundwork whereby we'll be able to benefit the most from these majalis. If I can just ask you to say salawat, please. So the topic of dhulm. Now dhulm, I just want to spend a few minutes defining it and then inshallah talking about it from the perspective. Dhulm typically is translated as oppression or injustice. But if we go and look at what the word actually means, it means more than what typically we think about oppression or injustice to mean in the society that we're living in, or at least in common parlance. Usually we think about injustice as being like, that, okay, there's these people whose rights have been taken, you know, there's the poor innocent civilians in Yemen who have been bombarded for years and they're starving to death. We think about the Palestinians who have been occupied and their land has been stolen from them, and many other cases. But when you go and look at dhulm, it's something which is an all-encompassing concept. It's very large. It has a lot of meaning. When the Quran describes two people who had gardens, Allah Ta'ala says there was two men who were gifted with gardens, and He uses this as a parable to show us about the importance of being thankful for all the blessings that Allah has given us. So initially, both of their gardens were doing well. One of them, of course, became more thankful to Allah. The other one used it as a way of becoming an arrogant rebel. But when Allah describes the gardens, He uses the word dhulm, and He says that the gardens did not do dhulm to them. Meaning what? Meaning that the gardens didn't come short. They didn't. The produce from the gardens didn't fall short of what was expected. So the literal meaning of dhulm has to do with the idea of falling short. But the wider meaning of it has to do with when you have something and you don't put it in its proper place. And one of the unique things about dhulm is that it is a feature that only exists in this world. Allah Ta'ala has created different realms of existence. After this world, all of us will be going to the hereafter. But as soon as we leave this world, the idea of dhulm, the concept of dhulm becomes non-existent. It no longer is there. Why is that the case? Because dhulm has something to do with this world and with us as human beings. Allah in the Quran, in Surah Al-Rahman, He says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم والسماء رفعها ووضع الميزان ألا تطغوا في الميزان. He says, the sky, we have raised it. And we have placed the mizan. The mizan meaning the scale. ألا تطغوا في الميزان. So that you do not rebel and you do not go beyond the means and use the scale and misuse it. What does that mean? What does it refer to? Some of the Mufassirin, the commentators of the Quran, they've explained that to say that the way that Allah has created the entire universe is that it's predicated on the concept of adl, or justice. You can see this if you go to the Taqween, if you go to the natural world, you'll see that everything is created according to a certain measure and proportion. You can see it when you go to the world of guidance that God has given us, whether it comes to our system of beliefs, whether it comes to the system of ethics or morals or law, everything is defined according to a very particular measure and balance that's in accordance with the needs of the people. And I just want to invite you to ponder upon this moment, for a moment, the idea that this universe is created on the system of justice. If you go to the natural world, you can look at anything and you can discover this. I mean, you know, they have entire channels dedicated towards, you know, describing nature, right? And they go and they explore different mysteries about nature. But as you know, our perspective is a bit different than maybe the perspective of those channels. They go and they say that, okay, well, there's these different animals, these different, you know, let's see, plants and birds and all that, and they do these things and look at, they're so, it's so wonderful, but they don't look at the cause behind that. Take, for example, the penguin. I was recently came to be aware of some of the beauties of the penguin, where you have this animal where even the colors of the feathers of the penguin have been created in a way to make it, when it's swimming in the water, to make it not be visible to predators. That same penguin that we look at and we almost laugh at the way that it flops around on the ground, its body is designed in a way that if it needs to slide down ice, it can do that in a very effective way. When it swims, it uses that same body design to, you know, go in these arcs on the water. And when it does so, it's able to get these beads of like drops of water that lines its feathers and its skin, and that way it reduces the friction. And many other things, whether it be its eyes, whether it be its flippers, whether it be the colors, the coating, its skin, the fur, everything is in a perfect proportion according to its needs. And that's the way it comes, that's the way it goes when it comes to God's creation. It's only a feature of this world, though, that you that this possibility exists of there being a being that will challenge the perfect order and the system of God. And that's the human being when it comes to the free will that God has given him. And that's where the concept of dhulm comes about. On one hand, the idea exists that everything in the earth and the heavens is created on justice. بِالْعَدْلِ قَامَتِ السَّمَاوَاتُ وَالْأَرْضِ, as the common saying is, there, it was there present before the time of Islam and also It was something that both the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, they also, you know, accepted that concept. But on the other hand, with the presence of free will, human beings have this ability to wreak injustice. Now, when it comes to the relation of that to Imam Hussein alayhi salam's struggle, it's something which is obvious. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, one of the reasons why he did his qiyam, why he did his uprising, was for the purpose of fighting injustice and establishing justice. But if we are to go to in deeper and look at different manifestations of justice and different lessons that we can learn on the concept of injustice and rooting it out from ourselves, from our family lives, from our social lives, from our community lives, there are many good lessons that we can learn. And inshallah, with the help of Allah, I would like to explore that and open that further in the upcoming nights. But I just want to pause here, and I just want to mention that one of the very interesting things that we can do when it comes to the incident of Karbala is to ask ourselves this question, which is, why is it that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did what he did? You know, when you go to the Quran and you see when God describes different stories of the people of the past, of the prophets and the struggles that they went through, God doesn't just talk about what happened. In fact, he spends rather little time looking at what actually happened. It's one of the unique features about the stories of the Quran, that a lot of the details are often omitted. God gives us the information that we need to know for the purpose of what the Book of Allah is meant for, which is to guide us to serving Allah and give us those teachings that we need in our lives. But one of the things that God does when he goes through the stories of those people is that he does talk about the underlying motivations. He talks about what kind of forces were present in the societies that these prophets went to. He talks about the reason for why the prophets were speaking and for the voice of truth and sometimes standing against their own community. And so we should take a cue from that. When it comes to Karbala, we should try to understand what is it that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was trying to do. If we go and look at that and we see what type of answers the scholars have given on that topic, those scholars who have studied it at various dimensions and aspects, we see a number of reasons that have been given. Some of them have been false. Like, for example, those who had maybe sectarian bias, right? They wanted to somehow downplay the mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. They said that Imam Hussein was looking to na'udhu billah, he was looking for worldly power. He wanted the khilafah for himself, and therefore he did his qiyam, he did his uprising. Which for many reasons, of course, is not valid. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, everything about his struggle and everything about his uprising and everything about his mission, it's clear that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was not seeking worldly power. And it was clear also to him that the outcome of his efforts would be his shahada, would be his martyrdom. Now, there are other people who say that, no, okay, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was, for example, he was asked by the people of Kufa to come. And being the imam of the time, he has to, you know, respond to the people who are calling him and asking him. And so Imam alayhi salam did so, which is one of the reasons, it's a valid reason. Some people say that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that he wanted to perform Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar. He was seeing that the way that the Muslim Ummah was going, the direction it was going, was something which was, it was swerving away from the teachings of truth, in particular with the appointment of Yazid into the position of the Khilafah. That was something that he couldn't stand for, and it was something that was going in a very deviant way, so therefore he had to speak out. And that also is a valid answer as well as to why Imam Hussein did what he did. Some people say that Imam Hussein alayhi salam's purpose was shahada. Why? Because shahada was something that he needed to go through in order to attain his special goal. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's, from the beginning, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, had indicated from the time of birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam that this son of Fatima was destined towards something special. His status was something that was beyond the status of others. And so when, for example, during the journey to Karbala, Imam Hussein sometimes was questioned as to why is it that you're going towards what is definitely going to end up in your being killed. The Imam alayhi salam would respond in some cases to some individuals who say that this is what I have been ordered to do by my grandfather, the Prophet. For example, Abdullah ibn Ja'far, you know, he comes to him and he says that, okay, he lays out the map for him. This is what's going to happen. This is the different movements. The people of Kufa aren't going to support you. This is what I've been ordered to do by my grandfather. For he has told me that there is a degree that is in paradise that is reserved for me that I will not attain except for through the means of Shahada. Now, all of these are different things that I mentioned, whether it be the need to respond to the call of people, whether it be the Shahada, whether it be Amr bin Ma'ruf Nahi an al-Munkar, even other reasons that have been given, these are all valid reasons. But perhaps we could say that the ultimate goal that Imam Hussein was striving for, it wasn't just these. These were just maybe means for attaining the final goal and the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal, one could say, was to establish that government of justice. And so that's why if you go and study the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he says that I am not doing what I'm doing ashiran wala batara. I'm not doing out of injustice. I'm not doing it as an arrogant tyrant. Why am I doing it? Because uridu an atluba, I wish to seek al-islaha fi ummati jaddi. I wish to seek to restore justice in the ummah of my grandfather. Wa an amura bil ma'ruf wa anha anil munkar, and that I wish to enjoin good and then to forbid evil. So the topic of justice is very much intertwined with the mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So as we're going through these nights, inshallah, we can be reminded of this as we're trying to seek justice on a personal level, as we're trying to seek justice when it comes to our interactions with other mu'mineen, and also when we're trying to analyze the systems of injustice in the societies that we live in, it'll be good for us to always tie this back to our purpose of being here and our remembrance of the martyrdom of Sayyidah Shuhada. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now that was an introduction, and I'm not so keen to hurry through and now jump to the actual main topic, because I feel that for something that's as important as these majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, it is good for us to take things slowly, step by step. And so I want to pause on that, and I want to go to looking at this majlis itself right here. And I want to ask myself and remind myself of its importance and what can I do and what we all can do to make the most out of this gathering here. We're blessed to be, as Brother Murtaza pointed out, in this new home. I know many brothers and sisters have been working very hard for a long time it was kind of a compressed amount of time, but many long hours to be able to put this together. May Allah reward them for their sincere sacrifices and efforts. This majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is not something that we can look at in isolation. We have to realize its significance. We have to realize its history. When was the first majlis of Imam Hussein actually carried out? Well, you can look at it from different angles, and depends on what you classify as a majlis. But maybe you could say that the first one happened with the birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Because as you know, in the narrations, we're told that when the grandfather of Imam Hussein, the Prophet of Allah, when his grandson was given to him, rather than showing that joy that a grandfather would normally show at the birth of his grandson, he began to weep. And when Sayyidah Fatima al-Zahra alayha salam asked him as to the reason for his tears, he was forced to disclose to her the ultimate shahada and the injustice that would be wreaked upon his grandson. And at that time, Sayyida Fatima alayhi salam was concerned, she was worried. She said that who is going to be there to mourn for him? Because if it's not just he who is going to be martyred, but along with his close companions as well too, then will it just be the case that his blood is then spilt and then his what he stood for and his remembrance will then come to an end? And the Prophet assured her at that time that there will always be a people, both men and women, who will come together and they will mourn and remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So the origins of the majlis are very ancient. And if you go into the day of Ashura itself, when Sayyidah Shuhada alayhi salam is being martyred, you see that the first mourner is his own sister, Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam. And she's the one who is crying, and she's the one who's mourning. And then after that event, both she and Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, they continue this, a tradition of mourning. At that time, it was done in the homes because of the political situation. It didn't allow for there to be any type of group commemorations. It was done in the homes. This continued to the time of Imam Baqir and Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. As you know, in that time period, because of the political situation, the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt were given a bit more space to be able to perform and carry out their expressions of Shiism. And so we see during that time that the majalis were held in, again, not in an open way, but still it was something that was becoming more widespread. The imams would invite poets in different occasions. In one of them, for example, the Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, he invites a famous poet by the name of Ja'far ibn Affan. And he says that, I want you to recount for us the martyrdom of my grandfather, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein has his close companions there. He has his family there. And the poet Ja'far ibn Affan, he begins to say his poetry until everyone is weeping. Imam Sadiq's beard is wet with tears. And he says to him that you should know that, Ja'far, that when we are doing this right now, the angels have gathered. And they are crying like we are crying. Rather, their tears and their weeping is even more than our tears. One more salawat, please. So this gathering, one more salawat, please. Okay. The Imam alayhi salam tells Ja'far about the gathering of the angels. He tells him that because of what you've done, your sins have been forgiven. He tells him that this is not just something which is related to this particular gathering, but rather anytime you have a group of believers who come together and they cry and they make each other cry over the martyrdom of my grandfather Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they too will receive that same reward. So what is this? This is the establishment of an institution, of a system, of a culture. In the times of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, he is able to establish the majalis in a semi-formal manner. And even the Khalifa of that time also participates in mourning over Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So this was something that was put into place by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And so it becomes a sacred gathering, a sacred institution. And that's something which I feel that we need to appreciate and understand. Because sometimes, when something becomes routine, then we might treat it like, well, it's routine. I have to go to my work during the weekdays. I have to go to school when after Labor Day. I have to do this, and I have to go to Majalis and Muharram. Okay, so I got to do that as well too. I'll just do it. No, it's not just about doing it. Right? This is not an ordinary thing. It requires special attention. What are some of the etiquette that we can observe when it comes to the Majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam? One of them is the concept of ikhlas, that we come here purely for the sake of Allah. Now, part of that, of course, is, you know, not doing it just to be shown, or not to like doing it so that we can, you know, put ourselves on social media and say, look at, I'm the Husseini warrior who's the one who's volunteering and putting together the programs. That's obvious. But part of it is also the concept of coming purely for the sake of Allah, meaning that I'm not doing it just because it's my yearly routine, where I have those set of black clothes, I gotta put them on, I gotta come in, and then I'm done. No. You know, the Imams, alayhi salam, they warned us against this concept of just falling into the habit of doing things out of habit. Right? For example, they would tell us that don't judge a mu'min by their prayers and by their fasting. Okay, not that, of course, a believer shouldn't be praying and fasting. That's granted. But they would say, don't judge them by their praying and their fasting. Why? Because how often it can be the case that a believer gets into the habit of doing these acts of worship, and if they were to leave them aside, they would just feel discomfort. But rather, you should judge them by seeing how they fulfill their promises and how much they speak the truth, because these are true markers of the character of a believer. I'm sure you've heard this hadith. It requires some depth of understanding to get the message of the imams from here. That sometimes it can be the case that we do things because we're just uncomfortable if we don't do them. But that's the extent to the depth with which we engage in it. Am I praying because I'm talking to the Rabbul Arbab, and I'm talking to Malikul Muluk, I'm talking to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, I'm talking to the one who owns every single aspect about me, including my very own existence? Do I feel that I'm standing in front of the one who ultimately decides everything that has to do with my benefit and my loss, my very life and my death? Oftentimes, no. I'm praying because I have to pray. That's it. I'm just doing it. Same thing when it comes to the Majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. That I shouldn't just be coming just because of that. I should be coming trying to understand that this is something important for me. There's some deep gifts that Allah Ta'ala has always placed in the remembrance of Imam Hussein alayhi salam for the believers. There are some barriers in the spiritual journeys of individuals that cannot be broken except through the remembrance of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I need these majalis. And I need to be here not just with my body, but with my heart as well too. There's a man who went for Hajj. He was a companion of the fourth Imam alayhi salam. His name was Shibli. I'm sure you've heard his story. He goes for Hajj and then he comes back. Now the Imam alayhi salam, you know, he speaks with him and he wants to teach him about this idea of that you need to do things at a deeper level. So he says that, okay, you went for Hajj, right? Yeah. Okay, so then did you, you know, at the miqat, did you change your clothes and did you put on like the ihram? He's like, yeah, I did that. And you did ghusl as well too? Yeah, I did ghusl as well too. Okay. So he says that, okay, when you change your clothes, did you also make a resolve to stay away from sin and that you're going to now dedicate yourself, when you're wearing the new clothes, that you're going to dedicate yourself towards the ta'a of Allah, the obedience of Allah? He says that when you put on the new clothes, did you also say that you're going to stay away from all sorts of nifaq and all sorts of riyah, all sorts of hypocrisy and showing off, and you're going to stay away from those doubtful things that might cast you into the disobedience of God? He says that when you perform that ghusl, did you also think about washing away all the sins and the mistakes and all the spiritual, you know, residue that might be there from all those years before this? And Shibli tells him that, no, I didn't think about that. I went there, I did those things, but those type of experiences, that type of depth, I didn't have. So what does the Imam tell him? He says that you didn't go to the miqat, you didn't change your clothes, and you didn't do the ghusl. So I'm telling myself when I read that type of tradition that I don't want to be among those who on the Day of Judgment, the Imam alayhi salam says that you didn't come to the majlis of Imam Hussein. Yeah, your body was there, but you didn't come. So this is something important, because especially when it comes to the culture and that institution that the Imams had given us, you see that they made it imperative upon their followers to be at that gathering and to be there with their hearts. How do we know that? Because they said that you go there and you cry. You can only cry if you're here with your heart. You know, these days, sometimes people are into this thing of like activism. They're like, okay, I need to go out and I need to like do these things. You know, I'm going to go and I'm going to like, I don't know, hand out these things. I'm going to campaign. I'm going to put these flyers. I'm going to give out these water bottles, give out these chocolates or whatever, all these things, right? But if you look at the spirit of the Ahlul Bayt, what they wanted is they wanted our hearts, right? They didn't want just to us to do things. And sometimes, you know, I understand that in these gatherings, we need people to, you know, do the sound system, people to do the recording, people to do the chai, right? I met, you know, brothers who, they dedicate 12 days of their life making chai, right? Because there's a lot of chai to be made. And it's an important thing for people, right? And may Allah reward them for that, right? But even the guy who's making the chai, he should realize that Imam Hussein alayhi salam wants his heart as well too. So if making the chai is going to mean that he can't give his heart to Imam Hussein, it's just going to be, that's the only experience he's going to have, then he needs to think about, then how can I also give some of my heart to Imam Hussein alayhi salam as well? So that's why one of the etiquettes that we need to have is this of being there with ikhlas, being there with our hearts. Another point of etiquette that I want to mention has to do particularly with our children. Now I understand, I have small children as well too, and I've been through this. It's sometimes very difficult, and it becomes very difficult for parents always, especially the mothers, may Allah reward them. It's very difficult sometimes that when we have to like take care of our children, we really want to participate, and it's like our children have our needs, and at the end of the day, we have to perform our responsibilities. And Allah knows that we try our best. And sometimes, you know, if we're not able to attend or we're not able to participate because we have to take care of the children, then inshallah, Allah will compensate in some other way. But I want to just make a point here that these majalis, one of the very important outcomes of them, it's always been there, inshallah, it continues, is to result in stronger love for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. That's why we're here, right? We need to go through this experience and the difficulties and the struggles involved with it. And one of the outcomes is the love of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, inshallah. In hadith, we're told, it's a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He's reported to have said, أَدِّبُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ بِثَلَاثِ خِصَالٍ, that train your children with three characteristics. Okay, he doesn't, when he's talking about these three characteristics here, you know, he's not talking about like STEM, right, or STEAM, or whatever it is they're talking about. Three characteristics, what are they? He says, حُبِّ نَبِيِّكُمْ, love of your prophet, وَحُبِّ عَلِي نَبِيِّكُمْ, and love of the family of the prophet, and حُبِّ الْقُرْآنِ, and love of the Qur'an. So two of these three, one of the primary ways of accomplishing that is the majalis of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And so as parents, we need to be setting up the stage for our children. We need to explain to them this philosophy. If what I'm saying is not making sense, then please go home and then explain to them in words that will make sense of why is it that we do these? Why is it that we have to sit through, even if it's a long, boring speech, and still it's important? Why is it that we have to go and sit on the floor, even though we like to be sitting on benches or chairs? These are things that need to be talked about. At home, we need to set up the environment as well too. At home, we should have a portion of our home, you know, kind of set up, decorated with some of the black sort of flags, even if it's some of the artwork, posters, not the whole thing, right? But it should be something special where the children feel this is the culture. We need to work, especially where we're at right now, where we're not part of a majority Shia culture. We need to work at that and help that happen. And the other point I want to make regarding the children, and this is my advice to the parents, also to the brothers and sisters who are helping to administer, is that let us make sure that this environment stays pure by not having people access their devices during the program, especially our children. This is a very important point, and I have to say it, and I know that I can speak freely because I know the brothers and sisters who are here to a certain extent, they won't feel bad. I have seen and experienced so many shocking incidents of children coming to centers which are meant to be gatherings of purity and of light and of the Ahlul Bayt and love and coming closer to Allah, but instead they end up having a polluting experience because they happen to be taught something or shown something that they shouldn't be. And sometimes, you know, like, you know, the whole experience is about like just playing video games or just, you know, talking or social media or whatever. And it's like, you know, is that what the center is supposed to accomplish? One of the brothers was speaking with the faith leader of another faith, and they were saying how in their programs, all their programs, whether it be prayers, whether it be speeches, whether it be whatever, commemorations, everyone, whether they be 2 years old or 80 years old, they're not allowed to be on their devices. And for the most part, they have volunteers who are kind of walking around and reminding people. For the most part, they don't need to because people have that innate sense of respect for the program that they're part of. And so we think about it, you know, like if I'm in a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and I'm sitting there and I'm checking my Facebook and I'm sitting there, I'm doing this, or and my kids are on that and doing, well, what's going on? Right? This is going to undo the very purpose for which, you know, we're here for. So that's my recommendation to the brothers and sisters regarding children. Now, the last thing I'll mention for tonight is I want to come back to this point that I need, and we all need, these majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. One of the unique things about Karbala is that it's not something that happened back 1400 years ago, and I'm just thinking back to that and remembering that past event. But rather, that same Karbala and that same event, I also have a role to play in it as well. And so do you. Because that same Imam alayhi salam who was there and at that time guiding people, teaching them, asking for their help, that same Imam alayhi salam in the spiritual world is very much active right now. Him and his forefathers and his children, all the way to the living Imam, all of them most definitely are nadir and are aware and looking at the people who have gathered in love and commemorating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I want to share with you one story that was inspiring to me, and then inshallah we'll move to the masaib. It's a story about this one man. He's alive right now. It's not like some story from like the past. His name is Salman. And Salman was born to a family where his mother came from a background of the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. But his father was one of those very staunch Salafis. And he was raised in a manner where he hated Shias. He was embarrassed about his mother. And, you know, he sort of fed this misinformation that, you know, Shias are like this and like that. He never used to, even when it came to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he used to consider him like an ordinary person who, na'udhu billah, made many mistakes, including fighting against the, you know, this and that, and all these different things. That's kind of his upbringing. He went to university, and then he went to a special course in Pakistan, where they train him on how to spread Salafi ideology. Within 5 minutes, he was taught all the techniques where he could convince any ordinary Muslim that of the Salafi sort of perspective. Here's the verses, here's the hadith, and bang, 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 here you go, now you're a Salafi. Now, it just so happened that when he went to university, he became friends with somebody who he later on found out was a Shia. And the thing that attracted him was, you know, he on one hand, you know, he was, obviously, it was hard for him because of his hatred, but he was so much enamored by the akhlaq of this individual. And he eventually just told him, all right, he's like, I don't understand. You know, you're supposed to be a Shia. How can you be having such good akhlaq? What's wrong with you? And that Shia brother, he just, you know, would smile. He never, like, got angry and so on and so forth. And finally, the Shia brother tells him one day, he says, that, you know what? I think it's time for you to attend a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So he says to him, he says that, what are you talking about? Like, these are bid'ah, it's like this, shirk, all these things, you know, why would I want to do that? And he says, no, I really think you should. And then eventually he convinces him, he says, okay, fine, I'll go just because of your sake, I'll go, I'll attend. So he comes into the majlis, and he's all like, you know, angry and kind of all like haughty, and he's like, what are these people? And, you know, they're dressed in black, all this stuff. He's like, I'll just sit in the corner and watch them do their shirk and all these things. And so, you know, he's sitting there critically judging everything that's going on. And the speaker mounts to the member and begins a speech. And he asks one question. He says that, do you know anybody in history like Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who would be willing to stand for what he did, knowing what would happen to his family and his children and his women folk after him? What was it that inspired him to do that? What was it that drove him to be able to do that despite knowing all these things? That question was the beginning of guidance for Salman. And, you know, he found himself that this was something that he couldn't answer. And as they started to do their, you know, commemoration, their sin azani, their latmiya, all these things, you know, he didn't participate, but he found himself crying. And he found himself reflecting, and he found himself going through all these teachings, and this began the journey of discovery for him. Eventually, Salman the Salafi became Salman the Shia. And the story is long, and it's something, you know, it's there, it's on the internet, he has his website, he's answered questions, he's explained his journey in detail. It's not just some story, it's there, you can go and read it, it's a real person, there's interviews and everything. He faced a lot of struggles, a lot of challenges, but my point is what? My point is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is still guiding people. He is still the Safinat al-Najah. He is still that ark of salvation. And he is still there for me and you as well too. So in these nights, we need to be asking ourselves this question that, okay, I'm talking about dhulm, I'm going to these lectures about dhulm, right? What can I do to turn away from dhulm? What can I do to have light in my life? What can I do to have somebody who leads a life of justice, who understands their purpose, who puts himself or herself in this great system that God has created exactly in the right place? May Allah Ta'ala help us to make the most out of these gatherings. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Tonight we are going to, inshallah, remember the martyrdom of a very, very great and special companion of Sayyid al-Shuhada, one of those true Shias who was in some ways the first of the martyrs, and therefore we are remembering him on the first of the nights. Muslim ibn Aqil was the cousin of the Imam alayhi salam and somebody that the Imam alayhi salam had great trust in and had great value for. And so when it came time to choose somebody who would represent him in Kufa, he chose Muslim ibn Aqil. And he told the Kufans that I'm sending to you somebody who is my brother and my cousin and my trusted representative. And when you see him, I command you to make bay'ah to him. This is the status of Muslim ibn Aqil. And Muslim was somebody who was wise, somebody who was brave, he was courageous, he was knowledgeable. He had grown up hearing the wisdom of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He was present in the Battle of Safin. He was a formidable warrior. And when he went to Kufa, he was a source of enlightenment for people and a breath of fresh air for them. They were so happy to see him. And so they pledged allegiance to him by the thousands. And when he was confident that they were with him, he sent a message to Imam Hussein alayhi salam that yes, the Kufans are with you. Yes, proceed to Kufa. And he went about preparing the grounds. But when Yazid found out about what was happening in Kufa, he replaced the governor Nu'man with the La'in ibn Ziyad, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, who was somebody who was savvy. And we see how the tides turned and things shifted because primarily due to the weakness of the faith of those who profess themselves to be the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And so when we cry over Muslim ibn Aqil, let us not just cry for him, but let us cry for ourselves as well too. Because we see that on one hand, the governor's mansion was surrounded by the followers of Muslim. But when Ubaydullah saw this, he started to send people amongst them to get them to defect. How did he do that? Because he started to plant fear in their hearts. If you support Muslim, you're going to lose this. You're going to lose that. We'll take away your property. We'll throw you into jail. We'll hurt your family. We'll hurt your children, and so on and so forth. Some of them were already in prison. Some of them became in prison. But anyhow, when the people were tested, for the most part, they failed. And this is what Imam Hussein al-Islam had told us. That when it comes to people, annasu abidu dunya, people are the slaves of the world. And what they have of the religion is just like a smattering. They just take a bit, and like if you just taste like a quick taste of something, that's how much they've internalized of the religion. وَإِذَا مُحِسُ بِالْبَلَاءِ قَلَّتِ الدَّيَانُونَ. When people are tested, then how few are those who really are committed to following the path of the religion. We see that Muslim, who is followed by thousands, that he is left with a thousand. And then when it comes to the nightfall, he is left with just tens. And when it comes to after the prayer at night, he is left with no one. And so Muslim ibn Aqil is walking the streets of Kufa. Nowhere to stay, no followers. Eventually he comes to a home where there is a lady who is waiting for her son. And Muslim pauses there, and she's a little bit worried and concerned. This is not the place for you. Why are you here? He tells her, I have nowhere else to stay. Can you offer me some shelter? Can you offer me a drink of water? But who are you? I am Muslim ibn Aqil. All these people before, all these people who were so-called followers, all these people who were so-called lovers of Imam Ali, who were in the city of Imam Ali, when it came to supporting Muslim in the difficult times, they abandoned him. But this lady, Tawa is her name, may Allah's mercy be upon her, when she's tested, she realizes that this is the representative of the Imam of the time, and she has a duty towards him. So she welcomes him in. She gives him water. She offers him food, but he refuses it, saying that, no, this is not the time for me to fill my stomach. He begins to worship Allah, engaging in munajat and prayers and night prayers and reading Quran. And she says to him that, why don't you take some rest? She says that, no, this is not time for me to rest. The next morning, he hears the sounds of approaching steps of the hooves, because after all, you know, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad was active and he was able to find information, and eventually the place is betrayed. He tells her that, please open the door for me, but you should know that you have fulfilled your duty. You have done your responsibility. It was because of your son that I was betrayed, but may Allah's mercy be upon you. And when he opens the door, out comes Muslim, but there are many of the enemy who have come to fight him. And Muslim ibn Aqil fights valiantly. They are unable to defeat him through normal techniques. They have to go up on the roof and shower down stones upon his neck and perform all sorts of crude acts of battle in order to be able to capture this man. When they send a message to Ubaydullah, they say that we can't do anything, we can't capture him because it's too much for us. He tells them that you have so many against one person. They tell him that, yes, but this is not an ordinary person. He is like an eagle or a lion who's fighting, who is angry, and we can't stop him. This is the bravery of Muslim ibn Aqil. But how much can one man do? He can stand for the truth. He can speak the truth, but he's just one man. And eventually he is surrounded, and they take him to the castle and the palace of the governor. And here we see some very tragic events. We see that he's very thirsty. He's not the trial of thirst begins here. He's very thirsty. He asks for some water. Eventually they give him the water. But when he goes to put the water to his lips, Muslim ibn Aqil, his face is bleeding so much that the water becomes filled with his blood. He spits out the water. He takes some more. But one time again, the same thing happens and it repeats again. Then he says that I have realized that even though I wanted some water, Allah's plan for me is not to give me the rizq of water right now. And that's something that I praise Allah for. If this is what Allah wants, then I will be patient as well too. As he is led up to the top of the palace, Muslim ibn al-Qil is remembering Allah Ta'ala. He is doing istighfar. He is saying, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. And he is crying. They ask him that, Muslim, are you so sad because you were not able to be the governor of this city? He says that by all means, that is not the case. There is no way that that is the reason why the tears come to my eyes. But rather, my heart is with that family who is in the desert and walking towards and making their way towards Kufa. It is them that I am concerned about. Can somebody please, please send them a message that the Kufans have betrayed Imam Hussein alayhi salam. They should not come towards Kufa. This is the concern that Muslim ibn Aqil has at this time. As he prepares for his shahada, Muslim ibn Aqil takes a moment and he turns towards where he thinks Imam Hussein alayhi salam will be, and he sends his final salam to the Imam of his time. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah al-Hussein. There's a poet who describes some of the tragedies that happen with Muslim ibn Aqil. He says, رَمَوْكَ مِنَ الْقَصْرِ إِذْ أَوْثَقُوكَ. He says that they threw you from the castle, from the castle after they had trusted in you. Will it be the case that you will die and no one will be there to cry for you? Because normally when somebody dies, you know, the people will be there who will cry, whether it be his wife or his daughters, there'll be somebody who will cry. But who is there to cry for you, or Muslim? Then he says that they dragged your body in ropes on the streets, and this is the same people who had before taken you as their leader. But that's okay. It's okay that there's no one there to warn for you, because there will be people who are on their way towards Kufa and they will mourn for you. What we're told is that when the news came to the caravan, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, everyone began to cry. Muslim didn't have anybody in Kufa to cry for him. But here he had Sayyida Zainab alayhi salam. Here he had the other women folk. Here he had Imam Hussein alayhi salam, whose eyes were filled with tears. He says, may Allah have mercy on Muslim. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. The sons of Muslim are very sad. The daughter of Muslim is young. She doesn't know what is happening. According to some reports, her name is Hamida. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, according to some reports, he says that please bring me Hamida, the daughter of Muslim. When they bring Hamida to him, Imam Hussein alayhi salam takes her, he's also her uncle and also the cousin of her father. He takes her and he begins to stroke her hair in her face in the way that is not normally done with somebody who is just normally in a situation. So she says to him that, oh my uncle, I see you stroking my face the way that I've seen you stroke the faces of orphans. Don't tell me, is it the case that something has happened to my father, Muslim? And Imam Hussein alayhi salam, it seems that he cannot answer her directly. He cannot tell her the truth of how they took the body and then the head came tumbling down. He can't tell her about how they dragged the body through the streets of Kufa, but he tells her that Hamida, from now on, I will be taking the place of your father. My sister Zaina will be your mother, and my daughters will be your sister. My sons will be your brothers. But we can tell her that Hamida, that is there for now, but on the day of the 10th of Ashura, you will have to bid farewell even to them as well. Ala la'natullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimin, wa say'alam al-ladhina zalamu. أيام منقلب ينقلبون.